Welcome to the fifth episode of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell. I'm a family physician, professor at University of Georgia, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus, which is an evidence-based online primary care reference. Check it out at www.essentialevidenceplus.com. Primary Care Update, we bring you commentary on the best recent research that's relevant for primary care physicians. The opinions expressed are those of the commentators, and this podcast does not represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. If you're a primary care doctor, be skeptical and read the article yourself to form your own conclusions. If you're a patient listening in, please talk to your primary care doctor about what you've learned. I'm joined today by my friends, Dr. Henry Berry and Dr. John Hickner. Dr. Hickner is both family physicians. Dr. Hickner is editor of the Journal of Family Practice, and Dr. Berry is professor of family medicine at Michigan State University. Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Doing well.
Our beautiful fall colors are gone up here in northern Michigan, and we're expecting snow in 2 days. Welcome
to permafrost. Permafrost. Oh, man. Don't they make you build foundations like 6 feet down up there because of the permafrost?
Oh, no basements. We just build on a slab.
Yeah. Too cold. Okay, too cold for me. So, Henry, I think you're going to start us off to tell us a little bit about some new ways to treat appendicitis.
Yeah, so you have this adult with a red-hot appendix. It's easy peasy, right? You just call the surgeon, send them to the operating room. Maybe not. This is a fascinating paper. It's actually one of several studies that we have seen over the last few years. This has a unique spin to it. So it's by Salminen and published in JAMA earlier this year. It asks the question, what is the likelihood of a late recurrence of appendicitis in adults initially given antibiotic therapy? So this was a two-part study, a bit of an iconoclastic study, which, by the way, I love. The first part of the study was 1 year follow-up. Adults with acute appendicitis were randomized to surgery or to antibiotics, and then they followed them over the course of a year. In the original trial, 3/4 of the adults initially treated with antibiotics did not require a subsequent appendectomy. Okay, so this part of the paper looks at what happens during the next 5 years of follow-up, which is really quite a long time interval. Turns out that very few patients subsequently developed acute appendicitis. So you started off with only with 25% developing acute appendicitis. Over the next several years, there was only about another 9 to 10% who developed appendicitis. What happened to those who were originally treated with antibiotics and then subsequently needed surgery? The complication rate was identical to the individuals who received surgery right from the get-go. So this was just fascinating. In other words, over 60% of adults who present with appendicitis never really need surgery, can be treated with antibiotics alone. This is a great place for shared decision-making. And I think that we have plenty of other data of a comparable nature that suggests that maybe we don't need to send people off to surgery. Mark, what are your comments?
Well, I thought it was a great study. I agree, and very nicely summarized. I think a couple of things to point out and really to emphasize that this is uncomplicated appendicitis only. And I think what this paper really adds is that we can have confidence that these patients aren't all going to bounce back in the next year or two, that this, you know, over time, like you said, about another 9% will recur, but overall their complication rates were lower, their outcomes were better. I'm sure it's cheaper. It's, overall a great option for our patients with uncomplicated appies.
I wonder how this is going to play out in emergency departments as the word spreads. This would imply that the first thing to do is not to call the surgeon, but rather to have a shared decision-making discussion with the patient and the primary care physician or the emergency room physician. So we will see how this changes practices across the United States in the next few years or not.
Great study. John, we're going to change gears here from appendicitis to hypertension, something a little more common in our practice. What have you learned from this week's second poem?
Our next study is called Reliability of Single Office Blood Pressure Measurements, published in Heart in 2018, page 1173, by Burkhardt and colleagues. And it really should read, the single blood pressure reading is not reliable. Now, let me get into the study, then I'll provide some comments, because this isn't really news, I don't think, to any of us, but it confirms what we know about that first reading. The authors recruited 1,000 consecutive patients and followed up on 800, and they took pressures properly. That is, they waited for 5 minutes of rest and then took not three, but four consecutive blood pressure measurements 2 minutes apart. And these readings were done by trained physicians, not by medical assistants. Now, what they found was that the first systolic blood pressure reading was more than 10 millimeters higher than the mean of the subsequent measurements, which is, of course, is a more reliable measure, in one out of four patients. And in about half, the systolic difference was more than 5 millimeters. So these are big differences. The diastolic differences were not as great, a difference of at least 10 in one of 20 patients, and one in five had a difference of more than 5 millimeters in the diastolic pressure. But probably most importantly, hypertension based on that visit would have been diagnosed in error in one of eight patients. That's 12% if only one reading had been obtained. So the bottom line is, again, what we already know. Don't rely on a single blood pressure reading to guide hypertension treatment because of these differences. Now, as I said, this is not news. The USPSTF has recommended that we even use home monitoring blood pressures rather than office readings. And there are these automatic blood pressure sphygmomanometers now that will take six readings in a row, toss the first one out, and average the next five, which is a more accurate way to go about it. We started doing that at Cleveland Clinic some years ago, and our quality scores improved quite a bit because we found out that we indeed had been overestimating blood pressure. So I can't emphasize the importance of accurate blood pressure readings, averaging a number of readings to base treatment of hypertension.
Henry.
Yeah, so this really demonstrates the wisdom of the ancient teachings that we had when we were in medical school, which is that you can't establish a diagnosis of hypertension based on a single reading on a single day. The standard is that you need three readings over three separate occasions. But it also reinforces to me the folly of making therapeutic decisions around changing antihypertensive therapy based on a single reading at a single visit as well, which seems to be the standard in at least my medical record system. Our EMR, if I've got a patient who comes in and their blood pressure is up, I get a red flag that says, stop, this guy has uncontrolled hypertension. So I think this paper basically suggests that maybe not so much.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that's almost a separate issue of an overeager EHR that's, you know, giving us too many warnings, and then we just get alert fatigue and, of course, ignore all the warnings, even the important ones. I think this is good. It's consistent with what we've seen. There have been other studies showing that, for example, how the blood pressure was measured in the SPRINT trial ended up being about, I think, 10 to 15 millimeters lower than how it's typically measured in practice. So it really does make a difference. And if we want to, you know, treat hypertension according to guidelines, we need to measure blood pressure the same way as in the guidelines. And I agree. I can't tell you how many times I've had patients who've come in woozy and somebody had increased their blood pressure medicine and we actually checked their pressures at home. They were doing fine, or even on the low side. So important poem, important reminder for us as we measure blood pressures. Henry, I think you have a quiz question for us.
Yes. So here's the scenario. You have a 10-year-old who comes in with a 2-day history of colicky abdominal pain, decreased appetite, and the pain has now started to migrate to the lower abdomen, more so on the right than on the left. Which of the following is the most important test in guiding treatment decisions? 1, a CBC. 2, a non-contrasted CT. 3, an ultrasound. 4, a detailed history and physical. Stay tuned.
All right, we'll look for the answer at the end of the podcast. So the next one is mine, and it is entitled Anticonvulsants in the Treatment of Low Back Pain and Lumbar Radicular Pain, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. It's in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, 2018, volume 190, issue 26, and it was by Enka and colleagues. So we're trying to reduce our use of opioids and for pain. Should we say opioids or opiates, Henry?
Whatever you would prefer.
Okay, I'll say both.
Narcotics.
Yeah, narcotic. Yeah, well, okay. I'm going to stick with opioids for now for pain. And so, we know NSAIDs are not well tolerated by some patients. And we know that anticonvulsants are often used for peripheral and diabetic neuropathy with some, evidence of effectiveness. So what we're seeing increasingly, though, is patients are getting these drugs prescribed for low back pain and for lumbar radicular pain, thinking that, well, a nerve is involved. Maybe these anticonvulsants would do the same thing. And it's become quite popular. I see patients come from the ER who have an acute, a sciatica episode, and they're given an anti-inflammatory, they're given Flexeril, and they're given gabapentin or something similar. So this was a systematic review that found 9 randomized trials comparing either topiramate, pregabalin, or gabapentin with placebo in patients with low back pain with or without radiculopathy. They were good studies. All but one of the studies was actually at low risk of bias. They used different pain scales, so they used standardized mean differences in pain scores as the main outcome. So if there was a score going from 0 to 10, another one 0 to 30, another one 0 to 100, this is a way of putting them all on the same scale. The 9 studies reported 14 total comparisons. Of the 14, only 2 showed any statistically significant benefit. One was a small study with only 43 patients of high-dose gabapentin, 3,600 milligrams a day, which in my experience, almost no one can tolerate. And the other was a study of 96 patients with low back pain who were given 300 of topiramate daily. The other topiramate study found no benefit, and none of the other studies of pregabalin or gabapentin found any benefit. Where they could combine the results and pool the results, there was no difference between groups. There was also no difference in serious adverse events, which is good, and they were pretty rare in both groups, 4 in pregabalin, 6 in the placebo group based on 2 studies. On the other hand, any adverse events, which included milder or moderate ones, were more common with one of these active treatment with one of these drugs. Relative risk was 1.4, so about 40% increase in any adverse effects. So I think the bottom line is that using these drugs, gabapentin, most commonly for painful conditions, for low back pain, for sciatica, is not effective and actually can cause some harm. They're also pregabalin. Some of these drugs are fairly expensive. And one other thing that I didn't know much about till recently, I heard this, that there's also increasing evidence that these drugs like gabapentin and pregabalin are being diverted and abused, sometimes mixed with heroin. And so they are we should be, aware of this and take that into account when we're thinking about prescribing these drugs. Henry, what do you think? Are you going to keep using gabapentin? I know it's your favorite drug in the world.
You know, Mark, thinking about acute versus chronic pain, if I'm going to bypass the acute pain because I think that's a different beast than for people with chronic low back pain. If you could see me on video, my head would be down, shaking my head, my fists raised to the sky, just shaking my fists because here's the problem, right? We can't use long-term NSAIDs, especially in our elders and those with significant comorbidities. We certainly can't be using opiates because they've been essentially outlawed. We can't use anticonvulsants. What's left? Oh, I know. In Michigan, just last night, we legalize marijuana. Maybe everybody could do that and nobody will care
right.
If they have back pain.
That's true. I think what we need is a really good placebo because we do know from another study that if you give patients a placebo and tell them it's a placebo, John, I think you covered this study.
Yes.
They got better. They had less pain. So what we need is a good placebo. So maybe 300 milligrams of gabapentin twice a day can be used as a sort of a semi-placebo because we know that at that dose, it's probably not harmful. I don't know. That's maybe a radical thought, but that might be one use for it.
Yeah, this is a disappointing finding, I would say. I have used gabapentin, as Henry has, in a number of pain patients. And of course, they seem to respond to it. Although the side effect of fatigue and sleepiness is real. But as you mentioned, a dose of 300 twice a day or even a couple of 300s at bedtime, patients seem to like it. So I don't know that I'll stop entirely, but mm-hmm. I'll open my eyes and know that it's not as effective as I thought it was. And by the way, it is dirt cheap. So at least gabapentin does not cost much. So that's one advantage. So yeah, we need something better.
Well, get busy, invent that new pain drug. I know that they're actually, you know, I follow the NIH funding announcements, and there's a lot of, you know, sort of basic science research and clinical trials going into new categories of pain medication. So, you know, maybe in a few years, we'll have something, some alternatives. Until then, medical marijuana, there you go. Unfortunately, we didn't have that on the ballot here in Georgia. So we're still, although we do have the cannabis oils now that I think that we can buy. Okay, so next is John. I think you have the last poem today.
Yes, it has a counterintuitive finding, at least for me, but I think this study combined with another that we talked about previously as a poem really is quite helpful. And the title is Effect of Immediate versus Gradual Reduction in Nicotine Content of Cigarettes on Biomarkers of Smoking Exposure, a randomized clinical trial that appeared in JAMA 2018, volume 320, page 880. Now, as you see from the title, they looked at intermediate outcomes, but let's go through the study and discuss it. The investigators recruited adults who smoked at least five cigarettes who were not prepared to quit at that time. So they were not, it's not a quitting cigarette study. They divided them into three groups. One was immediate nicotine reduction. The second was gradual nicotine reduction. And finally, usual nicotine content. Quite a clever study. They gave unlabeled cigarettes to the participants, and the immediate reduction dose of nicotine per cigarette was 0.4 milligram. The regular cigarettes have 15 to 18 milligrams of nicotine. So this is a big, big drop in nicotine on a daily basis. And then the gradual reduction group had nicotine cigarettes of various concentrations, and it was taken down. Now, they studied these patients over 20 weeks, and they tested breath carbon monoxide and other biomarkers of smoking reduction, of nicotine reduction, that is, and also of carbon monoxide, obviously. And the group that did best was the one that had the immediate reduction. They were much more likely to even not smoke cigarettes on a given day. And overall, the outcome was better. Now, this study is not as helpful as another study that was published in Annals of Internal Medicine in 2016, in which they did a randomized trial of smoking cessation and using immediate abstinence versus gradual withdrawal. And the quit rate at 6 months was 22% in the cold turkey group and 15% in the gradual reduction. So very interesting. People are more likely to quit on cold turkey versus gradual reduction.
Yeah, that's something where I think maybe there's, you know, again, shared decision making. That's one of our themes. And this is a case where, you know, we need to ask our patients, what do you think might work best for you? Perhaps encourage them to try cold turkey, but obviously it may not be, you know, right for everybody. They may have had a bad experience with it. But it certainly changed my practice to be more, a little more, try to give a little more direction to recommending immediate cold turkey rather than some sort of gradual extension.
Yes, me as well. Your comments are well taken, Mark.
Yeah, so smoking cessation is probably one of the most important things that we can encourage for our patients. It's complicated because it deals with not just the physical addiction, but there's also the psychological addiction. The differences in this study were not huge, nor were they in the study in 2016, which really opens up the possibility of negotiating with a patient, which would to them seem to be most feasible. So, you know, I'm stuck sometimes with the individual who is a pre-contemplative smoker. I'm not really interested. You know, we recommend to them, we tell them, you know, this is the single most important thing you can do for your health. It's going to save you lots of money, potentially prevent you from future adverse health risks, and only to have, when they do finally quit, to have it undermined because of the unconscious part of the habit. So part of my counseling has been to those individuals is to put them back in control. And so I encourage them to separate igniters from their cigarettes, and that by a significant distance, so that when they actually decide that they want to have a cigarette, it's a conscious choice, and they have to walk 15, 30 seconds to before they can actually ignite it. And that gives them a chance to say, wait a minute, I'm not sure I really want that cigarette.
That's a great idea. Is that something that's ever been studied, or is this just a strategy you've come up with?
I don't know if it's been studied.
Yeah, it makes sense, you know, certainly wouldn't be harmful. And it's one of those things too, where, you know, we have seen big declines in smoking in the U.S. over the last 30, 40 years. And there are a lot of reasons for that, you know, tobacco taxes, public health messaging. But I think also over time, we do have evidence that physician, primary care physician, harassment of our patients to quit smoking does have an effect. It's a small effect, but over time and with a large panel of patients, it can be effective. It's just tough for us to sometimes feel like we're having an effect because it's not always an immediate thing where the patient, quits smoking the next week because they talk to us. So good strategy, Henry, and thanks for that poem. I think you're going to give us the answer to the quiz. Is that right?
Yeah. So we have this 10-year-old with a 2-day history of colicky, abdominal pain, decreased appetite, lower abdominal tenderness, more on the right than left. And the question asked, which was the most important test in guiding treatment decisions, the CBC, non-contrasted CT, ultrasound, or history and physical? It turns out that history and physical is much more important, especially if your history and physical is guided using a clinical decision tool. So in children, something like the Alvarado score can really help you decide whether or not you need to do any further testing whatsoever, or whether if you and your surgeon would negotiate going straight to the operating room.
So for our readers or listeners who are not familiar with the Alvarado score, it's has been well validated. We did a systematic review and found that basically if it's significantly elevated, there's an 80%+ likelihood of appendicitis. And if it's low or close to normal, there's a very, very low risk. And so we can risk stratify our patients and maybe get the imaging on those who are moderate or high risk, but then the others we can send home with close follow-up. The elements of the score, and you can get it from mdcalc.com. You can also get it at Essential Evidence, are migration of pain, anorexia, nausea or vomiting, right lower quadrant tenderness, rebound pain, fever, leukocytosis, a left shift. And then there's another kind of flavor to this score. It's called the pediatric appendicitis score that's almost identical. And they have hopping up and down causes pain. It's specific for children, which I think is kind of a cute one. Make the kid jump up and down and see if that hurts. So those are the best independent predictors. I think it's useful because it helps focus our exam as well on what's most important.
Personally, I prefer the avocado score. And for the avocado score, you have the child eat an avocado and see if their pain gets worse or not.
Very good. Is it a Haas avocado or a Florida avocado? I was just reading about the difference of those today.
I believe it requires a Haas avocado. I'll check that one and let you know.
Yeah, check. Next, we'll get back to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Hope you all have a good week. Listeners, tell your friends about the podcast. Vote for us on iTunes. Give us 5 stars. Anything you can do that'll get more listeners and motivate us. To do this every couple of weeks and maybe even more often. Eventually, we're enjoying it and we appreciate any feedback as well. Send it to me at ebell@uga.edu. Any last words, John or Henry?
Yes, I'm polishing up my cross country skis.
Oh man, I'm so glad I'm in Georgia. Okay, good, and take care, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.